Earlier, the biblical prophet Micah proclaims that this will make us more secure. Along with advocacy for fair trade policies, we all have the opportunity to buy fair trade products through a growing network of nonprofit organizations that deal directly with producers, eliminating the middlemen and paying a fair, above-market price. Such fair trade products now being marketed in the United States, the United Kingdom, and throughout the developed world include coffee, tea, cocoa, chocolate, clothing, and crafts. One of the major products in the growing fair trade movement is, of course, coffee. Although a very heavily traded commodity, most coffee farmers living in the poorest countries of the world receive little. Coffee prices in the market fluctuate widely, and there are many steps between the farmer and the supermarket. Fair trade coffee is giving these farmers the alternative to deal directly with organizations that distribute the coffee in the United States and elsewhere. The prices they receive are above the market rate, enabling them to better support their families. Equal Exchange, an active fair trade coffee distributor in the United States, was founded in 1986 and is now the largest fair trade certified coffee company in North America, with 17 trading partners in 10 countries in Latin America, Africa, and Asia. Although not faith-based, Equal Exchange has partnered with national church organizations in a growing interfaith coffee program to market coffee for fellowship hours after worship. In 2004, these partnerships included Lutheran World Relief, Catholic Relief Services, the American Friends Service Committee, the Presbyterian Church, USA, the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, the United Church of Christ, the United Methodist Committee on Relief, and Brethren Witness. The organization notes, Equal Exchange's fair trade practices help build pride, independence, and community empowerment for small farmers and their families. A coffee processing plant in El Salvador, community stores in Colombia, the training of doctors and nurses in Mexico, reforestation programs in Costa Rica, new schools in Peru. These are all examples of the initiatives that co-ops have taken in their own communities with the income from fair trade. Definitive debt cancellation, wise aid programs, and trade justice are all crucial for addressing global economic inequality and improving the lives of millions of the poorest of the poor around the world. Debt, aid, and trade are the pillars of global poverty reduction, and they are becoming the moral imperatives of a growing popular movement that has strong support in the faith community. Diverse Christian groups are now mobilizing around the issues of international debt, aid, and trade. At one such event in London, I preached a sermon on this movement in the historic Wesley Chapel and from the revivalist John Wesley's pulpit. After the service, I met with some of the British government leaders who are most involved in the issues of debt, aid, and trade. America's leading ally in the world today is utterly convinced that terrorism will not be defeated without a new initiative for the economic development of the world's poorest nations. Today, some 800 million people around the world are malnourished. According to UNICEF and the World Health Organization, 30,500 children die every day in the developing world from hunger and preventable diseases. Almost 3 billion people, nearly half the world's population, live on less than $2 a day. 1.2 billion of them on less than $1 a day. In 1970, the United Nations estimated that commitments to significantly reduce global poverty can be met by increasing development aid to poor countries by $50 billion per year, and it set a goal to accomplish this with developed countries spending 0.7% of their GNP. They haven't even come close. The current average is between 0.2% and 0.3%. In several speeches over the past years, Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gordon Brown, has called for a new Marshall Plan of aid to developing countries. In a speech on December 17, 2001, at the National Press Club in Washington, Chancellor Brown recalled how U.S. Secretary of State George Marshall had committed the resources needed to rebuild Europe after World War II, believing that a true victory in that war would require a global fight against hunger, poverty, desperation, and chaos. Today, said Brown, there cannot be a solution to the urgent problems of poverty the poorest countries face without a substantial increase in development funds for investment in the very least developed countries. We must move from providing short-term aid just to compensate for poverty to a higher and more sustainable purpose, that of aid as long-term investment to tackle the causes of poverty by promoting growth. Brown is right. An international war against terrorism that doesn't target global poverty is doomed to failure. The U.S. government's 44% increase in the military budget since September 11th, from $306 billion in fiscal year 2001 to $441 billion in fiscal year 2004, will do little to eradicate the conditions of poverty, injustice, and lack of democracy which breed terrorism. Unless the United States and the United Kingdom can be persuaded to lead in this effort, it cannot really succeed, and the churches must help their governments to act. Together, the churches and the faith-based development agencies must create transatlantic and international alliances aimed at mobilizing our own people and pushing our governments toward effective moral and political leadership in seriously reducing global poverty. The Millennium Development Goals are not at all out of reach, but their achievement requires the creation of a new political will. They are indeed possible, but not without a spiritual engine to drive them forward. That is indeed what the religious community can best provide. Together, we can commit to work to make the possible possible. Today, we must aim our moral energy at the developing world in places like AIDS-infected sub-Saharan Africa, and in response to the urgent moral call to dramatically reduce global poverty. Our churches must convince our political leaders that such a moral and political initiative aimed at the root causes of global injustice will enable the war against terrorism to succeed far better than dropping more bombs on more countries. This may not be the kind of faith-based initiative that our political leaders had in mind, but it may be the kind of witness that many churches may now be ready to offer. There are many signs that the churches may be ready to take just such an initiative. One very powerful sign is how a growing number of church-based organizations and leaders are being drawn to respond to the crisis of HIV/AIDS. After many years of reluctance to engage the issue, many surprising people and groups, including many conservative evangelical leaders and organizations, are joining the fight against AIDS. Today, 9,000 people will die of HIV/AIDS, and almost all of them will be poor. They simply can't afford the drug treatments that prolong life. The organization World Vision says it well. For the majority of patients in poor countries, AIDS is a death sentence, not a chronic, manageable condition. Today, 14,000 new people will be infected with the disease, most of them in poor countries. 42 million already have it. 22 million have already died. And the World Health Organization puts the number of new infections at 5 million. The world has never seen a public health crisis like this. Given the numbers, one could say it is a crisis of biblical proportions. The good news is that the churches are changing. We must admit that the churches have been slow to respond. AIDS has carried a sexual stigma for the churches, and we didn't want to deal with it. The early perceptions of the disease were mostly associated with homosexuality, and the church didn't want to deal with that either. But most victims of HIV/AIDS today are women and children, infected by the promiscuity of men and exacerbated by their poverty. An entire generation of children, 13 million worldwide, have been orphaned by AIDS and face a bleak future without our immediate support. We are finally seeing new church leadership and, perhaps most significantly, new evangelical leadership. We can now point to strong and unequivocal statements of commitment from groups like World Vision, World Relief, and the National Association of Evangelicals, along with the Catholic bishops and the mainline Protestant Church World Service. HIV/AIDS is awakening the conscience of the churches. Some have likened AIDS to a modern-day leprosy, the terrible scourge of Jesus' day. The Gospels note that Jesus went out of his way to embrace the lepers who were isolated and abandoned by the society and the religious people of his day. He instructed his followers to heed his example. Today, Christians are starting to follow Jesus, who said, "I was sick, and you took care of me." Against a health crisis unlike anything the world has ever seen, the faith community is beginning to raise up a prophetic voice and undertake a new faith-based initiative on HIV/AIDS. To take such an initiative that will help in both the prevention and treatment of AIDS is now quite simply a matter of good faith and of making good on faith. More than 12 million orphan children in Africa alone demand our response. There can be no excuses. It is a moral imperative, as well as a political necessity. For all of us, it is a matter of faith. The meeting room was packed to overflowing, with students sitting on the floor, standing along the back wall, and spilling out the doorways to the corridor. The topic was social justice, and I was about to engage a new generation of Christian activists. Our discussion ranged from growing economic inequality in the United States to the failure of the American war in Iraq, to the world's pandemic of HIV/AIDS, to the most effective means for global poverty reduction, to protection of the environment, to abortion. This was the University of Notre Dame, and these were young Catholic student activists. Political liberals generally fail to comprehend how deep and fundamental the conviction on the sacredness of human life is for millions of Christians, especially Catholics and evangelicals, in forming their view of abortion. They include those who are quite committed and even radical on other issues of justice and peace. Left-wing political correctness, which now includes a rigid litmus test of being pro-choice on abortion, really breaks down here. And the conventional liberal political wisdom that conservatives on abortion are conservative on everything else, too, is just plain wrong. Christians who are economic populists, peacemaking internationalists, and committed feminists can also be pro-life on the issue of abortion, especially if they are also Catholics or evangelicals. The roots of this conviction are deeply biblical, perhaps best expressed in Psalm 139:13. "For it was you who formed my inward parts. You knit me together in my mother's womb." For many, it is also consistent with the commitment to nonviolence as a gospel way of life. And there are literally millions of votes at stake in this liberal miscalculation. Virtually everywhere I go, especially during an election year, I encounter many moderate and progressive Christians who find it painfully difficult or even impossible to vote Democrat, given the party's highly ideological and very rigid stance on this critical moral issue, a stance that they regard as pro-abortion. Except for this major and, in some cases, insurmountable obstacle, these voters would be casting Democratic ballots. Ironically, the Republicans who actively and successfully court the votes of many Christians on abortion are much more ecumenical in their own toleration of a variety of views within their own party. For example, fellow Republicans have not enforced anti-abortion orthodoxies on their rising new star, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, whose pro-choice views seem not to be a problem, not even, apparently, for the religious right, whose high-profile leaders have been virtually silent about Schwarzenegger's pro-choice abortion stance and even his admitted history of womanizing. Indeed, there is now a long list of pro-choice Republicans who appeal to the more culturally liberal but affluent suburbanites whose support the party seems to regard as crucial to its success. But to be a pro-life Democrat is to be a very lonely political creature in America. Former Pennsylvania Governor Robert Casey, a Catholic, was denied the opportunity to speak at the 1992 and 1996 Democratic conventions because of his pro-life views. It didn't matter that Casey was very progressive on both economic and foreign policy questions and was a particularly outspoken supporter of women's rights. He just didn't have the right position on abortion. Former Ohio Congressman and evangelical Christian Tony Hall experienced similar discrimination as a pro-life Democrat, despite being perhaps the most courageous congressional champion on issues of hunger and poverty. Nobody gets to speak from the Democratic Convention rostrum whose abortion views don't toe the party line. And the Democratic National Committee refuses even to allow a link from their website to the principal pro-life Democratic group, which now includes many office holders. High-profile pro-life Democrats like the new Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid and former House Whip David Bonnier provide some hope for a broader dialogue. On pragmatic grounds alone, Democrats, like Republicans, could still take a strong party stance, their official position being pro-choice, yet offer some space for different positions along a spectrum of practical options. Such a respect of conscience on abortion and a less dismissive approach to conscientious dissenters to Democratic orthodoxy would allow many pro-life and progressive Christians the permission they need to vote Democratic. But if the Democrats were really smart, they would do something more. The Democrats could still affirm that they are still the pro-choice party, but then also say what most Americans instinctively believe, that the abortion rate in America is much too high for a good and healthy society that respects both women and children. They could make a serious public commitment to actually do something about significantly reducing the abortion rate. The Democrats could try to unite both pro-choice and pro-life constituencies around goals that could actually become the basis for some new common ground, that is, really targeting the problems of teen pregnancy and adoption reform, which are so critical to reducing abortion, while offering real support for women, especially low-income women, at greater risk for unwanted pregnancies, providing meaningful alternatives to women caught in difficult decisions about unexpected pregnancies could also be a common project. They could follow the lead of a new alliance of both pro-choice and pro-life women who call themselves the Common Ground Network and work together to find real solutions to the abortion problem. Pro-choice feminist leaders like Naomi Wolf are taking the moral issue of abortion seriously, while female pro-life leaders often take women's rights and responsibilities more seriously than do many of their conservative male colleagues. Indeed, the rhetoric of the Democratic Party on abortion would seem to support such a plan of action. The 2000 Democratic Party platform says, "Our goal is to make abortion less necessary and more rare. We must continue to support efforts to reduce unintended pregnancies, and we call upon all Americans to take personal responsibility to meet this important goal." The platform even said that the party recognizes different views on issues of personal conscience like abortion and capital punishment. "We view this diversity of views as a source of strength, not as signs of weakness." Unfortunately, these words were removed from the 2004 platform. Restoring them would at least provide a basis for a better practice. Just providing a website link to Democrats for Life, allowing pro-life Democrats to speak at party conventions, and, most important, taking a proactive initiative to dramatically reduce abortions, would be a real turnaround. Given the bitter partisan division on the issue of abortion, it may be that the Democrats are the only ones who could initiate a common project to greatly reduce abortions in America. But underneath the strong convictions felt by the Notre Dame students on abortion is something deeper than politics. The most thoughtful ones speak of a consistent ethic of life, which derives from the heart of Catholic social teaching. It was Chicago Cardinal Joseph Bernardin who coined the phrase, "a seamless garment of life," which clearly links the life issues of abortion, euthanasia, capital punishment, nuclear weapons, poverty, and racism as critical components of a consistent ethic of life. The Catholic bishops themselves teach against single-issue voting, which focuses on only one issue, like abortion, to the neglect of all the rest. In their 2004 statement on faithful citizenship, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops noted, "We hope that voters will examine the position of candidates on the full range of issues, as well as on their personal integrity, philosophy, and performance. We are convinced that a consistent ethic of life should be the moral framework from which to address issues in the political arena." One young student at Notre Dame passionately reminded the group that a legal practice that kills 4,000 unborn children every day is an urgent moral imperative. But she was then reminded that 9,000 people each day now die of AIDS, 30,000 children perish every day because of hunger and diseases, mostly due to poverty, and as many as 500,000 are lost each year in international conflicts and wars. All agreed that a more consistent ethic of human life is sorely needed. The tragedy is that in America today, one can't vote for a consistent ethic of life. Republicans stress some of the life issues, Democrats some of the others, while both violate the seamless garment of life on several vital matters. But the consistent life ethic still serves as an invaluable plumb line by which to evaluate all political candidates and parties. The other most controversial life issue is, of course, the death penalty. On June 11, 2001, Timothy McVeigh was executed for the bombing of the Oklahoma City Murrah Federal Building, which killed 168 people, including 19 children. There was overwhelming public approval. Gallup polling showed 80% support. In fact, Gallup found 23% of those who supported the execution were generally opposed to the death penalty. But McVeigh was an aberration, a confessed, unremorseful mass murderer. And unlike many, he had competent legal counsel every step of the way. Like the rest of the country, the Oklahoma bombing victims' families were divided on the question of capital punishment. The Washington Post published a front-page story on the contradictory reactions of families. Some couldn't wait to see McVeigh die. Others had become eloquent opponents of the death penalty. One of the most poignant stories was that of Marcia and Tom Kite. Marcia's 23-year-old daughter was killed in the bombing, yet Mrs. Kite was not interested in watching McVeigh die. "Viewing the execution does not seem mentally healthy to me," she said. "It won't bring my daughter back, but Mr. Kite has chosen to witness the execution. I hope it will give me peace knowing he will be eliminated." But this execution was not likely to provide any of them with what they really need to heal the pain and loss they feel. Honestly, nor will time or anything else we can really offer. Even in the loving arms of a God who also grieves such terrible human losses, the pain never really does go away. After a visit to Oklahoma City, I wrote of the emotional impact of the memorial field of empty chairs symbolizing the victims of the bombing. Some were little chairs that reminded us of the children who were killed in this unspeakable violence. On the first anniversary of the bombing, a simple service was held at the memorial. The families and friends of those who had died in the blast stood silent for 168 seconds, one for every person who was killed. The service ended with the ringing of church bells and the song, "Let There Be Peace on Earth." At the same time, the final preparations were being made in Terre Haute, Indiana, for another death, Timothy McVeigh's. "I am against the death penalty in principle. We simply should not kill to show we are against killing. It's also easy to make a fatal mistake, as alarming DNA testing has demonstrated. The death penalty is clearly biased against the poor, who cannot afford adequate legal representation, and is outrageously disproportionate along racial lines. Few white-collar killers sit on death row, and fewer are ever executed. And there is no real evidence that it deters murder. It just satisfies revenge." But that's a human impulse that is easy to understand in the wake of a crime as heinous as the bombing in Oklahoma City. If anybody ever deserved the death penalty, it is McVeigh. Like many Americans, I was angry with him. I reacted like a father when he described the children in the daycare center he murdered as collateral damage in his political war. He's not just remorseless and cold, as many have accused. He's proud of what he did. But I still didn't think we should kill him. McVeigh was a mass murderer, but he was no longer a threat in prison. McVeigh wanted to be executed. Why give him what he wanted? He waived all appeals in order to speed the process. In his mind, he hoped to become a martyr to a small but dangerous group of twisted souls like himself. Why stoop to his level and kill him as he so ruthlessly killed others? Instead of giving McVeigh the dramatic end he desired, why didn't we really punish him for what he had done? An assessment of the overall state of the death penalty after McVeigh shows that the tide may be turning. A spring 2003 Gallup poll showed 74% favoring the death penalty and only 24% opposing it. Yet when the question is asked, if you could choose between the following two approaches, which do you think is the better penalty for murder? The death penalty or life imprisonment with absolutely no possibility of parole? Only 53% favor death, while 44% favor life without parole. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor spoke to the Minnesota Women Lawyers Organization in July 2001, shortly after McVeigh's execution. What made headlines was her statement that the system may well be allowing innocent defendants to be executed. Her remarks were significant since she has supported the death penalty and has been the key vote in several cases. Justice O'Connor noted that 90 death row inmates have been exonerated since 1973. According to news stories, Justice O'Connor emphasized the importance of effective counsel, noting that in Texas, for example, defendants with appointed counsel are 28% more likely to be convicted than those who can hire their own attorneys and are 44% more likely to receive death if convicted. Perhaps it's time to look at minimum standards for appointed counsel in death cases, she said. Timothy McVeigh's was the most highly publicized death penalty case in memory, and the FBI forgot to turn over 3,000 pages of documents to McVeigh's counsel. Many wondered what mistakes are routinely made with far less famous death row defendants, especially those without adequate counsel. And after the exoneration of more than a dozen death row inmates over the years in Illinois through DNA testing, Republican Governor George Ryan declared an indefinite moratorium on executions in that state. Then, in January 2003, as his last act in office, Ryan commuted the sentences of 167 prisoners who had been sentenced to death. In his statement, Ryan said, "Our capital system is haunted by the demon of error. Error in determining guilt, and error in determining who among the guilty deserves to die." What effect was race having? What effect was poverty having? Because of all these reasons, today I am commuting the sentences of all death row inmates. The use of the death penalty in the United States has attracted international attention. During President Bush's first trip to Europe in June 2002, anti-death penalty demonstrations were held in several European cities. The International Court of Justice has ruled against the United States in several cases involving the execution of foreign nationals, saying that the executions violated international law, because the United States had not informed consular officials of the arrest and conviction of their citizens. Declining public support, growing international outrage, and deeper legal and political questioning may all add up to more serious and sustained efforts to end the death penalty in the United States. President Bush's strong advocacy of capital punishment and record number of executions in Texas may actually be helping to focus the issue. Only God can ultimately judge a person's soul, but it is the right and the responsibility of society to punish crime and not just rehabilitate the criminal, especially when the crime is as horribly violent as McVeigh's. When someone takes other lives so deliberately, they should be deprived of any normal life themselves. The only adequate alternative to the death penalty is life without parole. If a convicted murderer repents, as some have suggested McVeigh might have someday, it would be an occasion to celebrate the grace of God, but not to free the killer. The murderer's penance would then be to minister to other prisoners on the inside. Support for the death penalty in the United States is beginning to decline, even though McVeigh was an exception, and moratoriums on capital punishment are emerging in some states. That will only continue if death penalty opponents are willing to take Murder One just as seriously as those who support capital punishment. According to Bureau of Justice statistics, at the end of 2003, there were 3,374 people on death rows in 37 states. and the killing continues. In the last 4 years, nearly 300 people have been executed. As Bishop Fiorenza of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops said, "Despite their horrible crimes, the men and women on our nation's death rows are often themselves poor and forgotten. We believe that we have other means to keep society safe from murderers, means that demonstrate a respect for life and ensure that innocent people will never be put to death. It's called a consistent ethic of life, and it should not be selective. It is selective morality, imposed in partisan political ways, that has so divided us politically. How can our affirmation of a culture of life, as Pope John Paul has called for, serve to bring us together across ideological and political battle lines? And even more important, how can the precious gift of life be protected and preserved? We are all needed for that battle." Sojourners Magazine put out a study guide on racism in America that was used in communities across the country, in weekly sessions often co-sponsored by black and white churches. I wrote the opening article in the study guide, which we entitled America's Original Sin. The piece began, "The United States of America was established as a white society, founded upon the genocide of another race and then the enslavement of yet another. We named racism theologically as America's original sin." I've never received so many letters in response to an article, or especially to an opening line. Some attacked the sentence as outrageous, while others thanked me for being so courageous. I was puzzled. The controversial line was neither outrageous nor courageous, but rather was simply a statement of historical fact, just a description of how the United States of America was established. America's original sin has affected most everything about our nation's life ever since. Slavery and the subsequent discrimination against black people in America is of such a magnitude of injustice that one would think national repentance and reparations would be called for. But neither has ever come. Even apologizing for this great sin has proved to be quite controversial. In the spring of 2000, Representative Tony Hall of Ohio called on Congress to apologize for slavery. That's right, apologize. Say we were wrong. Say we're sorry. On a sunny day in June, I stood with Tony Hall and Representative John Lewis of Georgia, along with a handful of other clergy, near the east steps of the U.S. Capitol, as Hall made the historic announcement. Tony Hall is known for asking not what's in it for him, but rather, what's the right thing to do? And he discovered, to his surprise, that the U.S. government had never apologized for slavery. In recent years, Hall pointed out, there have been many public apologies. Congress has apologized to Japanese Americans for imprisoning them during the Second World War, and to Native Hawaiians for helping overthrow the Kingdom of Hawaii a century ago. Other countries have also apologized. Britain's Prime Minister apologized to the Irish people for failing to relieve the 19th century potato famine. East Germany apologized for the Holocaust, and Japan's emperor apologized for atrocities in Korea. And in recent years, many religious leaders and bodies have apologized for slavery: the Pope, the Southern Baptists, the Methodists, and the National Association of Evangelicals. The state of Florida has both apologized and paid reparations to victims of a race riot in the city of Rosewood. Tony Hall said he was amazed when his research in the Library of Congress revealed that the U.S. government had never apologized for enslaving millions of people, tearing them from their families, killing, torture, beating, and brutalizing fellow human beings. He said that an apology provides the foundation for a new beginning, and that such an apology should not be wasted. Restoration, even some kind of restitution, and genuine healing should follow, he said. We teach our children to say they're sorry when they've done something wrong. What do we think black children and white children make of our failure to even say we're sorry for slavery and racism, let alone to make any restitution? Hall said we should set the right example for our children. Yes, our children. I am very conscious of how the discovery of racism in my city, nation, church, and community of friends and family deeply affected my own childhood and teenage years. Now I am a father, raising two young boys in a diverse urban neighborhood in Washington, D.C., watching my own children's reactions to their discovery of America's great racial offense has been instructive. Even before my son Luke was 2 years old, he loved to go for walks with his mom and dad, to the park, to the subway, to a restaurant, to church, or especially to a party. And what he always wanted to do was meet people. Luke greeted nearly everybody he met or passed. There are still many spots around town where he's made great friends who love to see him coming through the door. "Hi, hi, hi," he would say to everybody. "Hi, man. Hi, boys. Hi, lady," he exclaimed with his winning smile, and if he'd heard somebody's name before, he would be almost sure to remember it. Walking to the subway, Joy and I noticed how Luke was saying hi to everyone, black, white, Latino, Asian, male, female, young or old. It was obvious that Luke saw no differences that mattered to him. Everybody got his happy greeting. His only preference was for people who talked back to him, and most did. It made me sad that, in ways both subtle and direct, his society would soon start teaching him about racism. Of course, we hoped that we could teach him, too, about the need to overcome it. But it is a marvelous thing to watch a little white boy walk through streets that pulse with America's diversity and want to meet everybody. I've watched my son's technique carefully, because it seems easily to break down racial barriers, sullen looks, and angry stares. I've paid close attention because, after all, racism is not natural. It has to be carefully taught. Truth-telling about race requires that we understand and confront the purposes that racism plays in American life, even today. And in America, racism has always had a purpose. Slavery, of course, carried an enormous economic profit, as did subsequent racial discrimination, first free and then cheap labor for building a new nation and a growing economy. But the purposes went even deeper. Race has always been a dividing distraction in American life. By offering white people an other to blame and resent for their own problems, attention to the real problems of wealth and inequality in America have always been distracted and diverted. While racism has always had an economic motive, its consequences touch every area of our lives. We have been fractured by race, divided into communities that, although living in the same cities, inhabit different countries. Finally, it is our souls that have been fractured by race. It was a Republican president, Abraham Lincoln, who fought for the freedom of black Americans and famously said, "A house divided against itself cannot stand." But today's Republicans, going back to the shameful manipulations in the South by the Nixon Republican Party, win elections through strategies of racial division. Yet the Democrats, the party of Johnson and Kennedy, have long taken black voters for granted. So black Americans have few political choices today. One party uses them as a wedge issue to draw working-class whites, while the other depends on their support without offering substantial policy proposals to redress their grievances. As Howard Dean said in a pivotal South Carolina campaign speech, "In America, there is nothing black or white about having to live from one paycheck to the next. Hunger does not care what color we are. In America, a conversation between parents about taking on more debt might be in English or it might be in Spanish. Worrying about making ends meet knows no racial identity. Black children and white children all get the flu and need the doctor. In both the inner city and in small rural towns, our schools need good teachers. When education is suffering in lower income areas, it means that we will all pay for more prisons and face more crime in the future. When families lack health insurance and are forced to go to the emergency room when they need a doctor, medical care becomes more expensive for each of us. When wealth is concentrated at the very top, when the middle class is shrinking, and the gap between rich and poor grows as wide as it has been since the Gilded Age of the 19th century, our economy cannot sustain itself. Stagnant wages affect both black and white workers, and neither is responsible for the policies that create them. Dean said that Americans, black and white, are working harder for less money, with more debt, and less time to spend with our families and communities. He reminded his audience that a majority of children living in poverty in America are white, 8 million of a total 13 million. The former presidential candidate said, "It's time we had a new politics in America, a politics that refuses to pander to our lowest prejudices. Because when white people and black people and brown people vote together, that's when we make true progress in this country. Jobs, health care, education, democracy, and opportunity. These are the issues that can unite America. The politics of the 21st century is going to begin with our common interests." The best part of Dean's speech for me was this: if any politician tries to win an election by turning America into a battle of us versus them, we're going to respond with a politics that says that we're all in this together, that we want to raise our children in a world in which they are not taught to hate one another, because our children are not born to hate one another. We're going to talk about justice again in this country, and what an America based on justice should look like. An America with justice in our tax code, justice in our healthcare system, and justice in our hearts as well as our laws. The politics of race and the politics of fear will be answered with the promise of community and a message of hope. One of the groups most directly affected by these racial dynamics is black youth, especially African American young men. I see it every day and feel a mounting concern. Many black youth simply feel left out and left behind in America. The white majority little understands or even cares about the great tragedy of how the black anger our society generates in African American youth becomes both self-destructive and a dangerous obstacle to success. This is why most black parents in America worry about their sons, and why young black men in America are becoming an endangered species. Truth-telling about race also suggests the responsibilities that parents and other black leaders have to teach the most basic moral values to their children, to directly counter the false and dangerous consciousness of the violent, hedonistic, and consumerist society their children are being dangerously tempted by. Just because white society has yet to do the right thing about race in America is no excuse for the victims of that neglect not to do the right things in their own lives. That insight is always key for an oppressed people and is essential for eventually overcoming their oppression. The drug dealers, gangbangers, and rawest rappers simply must not be acclaimed as role models for the next generation of black youth. Rather, it is the persistent adherence to core spiritual values that will finally achieve social justice, economic equality, and personal freedom. And as far as spiritual values are concerned, it may be that religious congregations in both minority and white communities will play a major role in ultimately achieving racial justice and reconciliation. Those congregations are still the most universally present institutions in most communities, especially poor communities, and are the natural keepers of the values a society and the poor must need to remember. I've written in other places about the extraordinary role black churches have played in overcoming horrendous youth violence in cities like Boston, and the key contributions that Christian, Muslim, and Native American spiritual leaders have made to gang peace summits around the country. But more unexpected is the surprising new focus on racial reconciliation and even racial justice among white evangelicals in America. There is more conversation about race in many evangelical circles today than in the more predictable mainline churches, many of whom seem to have run out of energy on the subject. What seems to be emerging now is something more significant than merely evangelical blacks and whites hugging and singing Kumbaya together. While many evangelical and Pentecostal churches remain overwhelmingly white and have yet to give up substantial power to people of color, much of their growth is coming in poor communities of color, both at home and abroad. That has already changed the political dynamics in traditional organizations like the National Association of Evangelicals. The NAE was unable to speak out in support of the U.S. war in Iraq, which they historically might have done, precisely because their member churches of color were mostly opposed to the war. The Evangelical Covenant Church, of very white Scandinavian origins, now sees its primary growth in the African-American community and even in Africa itself. Claiming its historical roots as an immigrant church, the Evangelical Covenant now embraces the multicultural future of America as its own future too, making it, in my opinion, the most interesting church in America today. And out of the Covenant's emerging multicultural identity is coming a powerful and prophetic commitment to social justice and peace. All that affirms what the Sojourner's Study Guide said 20 years ago, that racism is a theological offense, a spiritual test, and not merely a political and economic issue. It was, after all, a primary theme of Paul's missionary journeys, the reconciliation of two peoples, Gentiles and Jews, in the body of Christ. He proclaims in 2 Corinthians 5:18 that God, who reconciled us to Himself through Christ, has given us the ministry of reconciliation. As America moves into a decidedly multicultural future, Paul's command and example become increasingly relevant and challenging. To rise to the challenge, the racial conversation in America must become more and more honest if it is to take us anywhere. The discussion must be truth-telling, and it must be genuinely two-way and now multi-way. That is, we must be able to confront one another, even as we seek to reconcile. Indeed, there really is no reconciliation without confrontation. Whites will continue to bear the responsibilities of privilege. Those who benefit from oppression are obligated to change it. Yet historically, oppressed racial minorities have their own responsibilities too, for their values, behaviors, and choices. While race affects much of our national and communal lives, it doesn't determine everything. Whites must be willing to see and acknowledge where race clearly affects benefits and outcomes. And blacks, along with other minorities, must not always play the race card, especially when other factors are clearly involved. Truth-telling will be required from all of us, but the rewards of our truth-telling could be great, and we really have no other moral choice. I'll admit it, I like a good football game, and this turned out to be a very good one, after a boringly slow start. But what everybody was talking about the next day was the baring of Janet Jackson's right breast. Justin Timberlake's little grope and tear-off of Jackson's bustier was the grand finale to their sex-simulating dance to a song called Rock Your Body, which ends with the romantic line, "I gotta have you naked by the end of this song." And that's just what he did. But that was only the crude climax to what Washington Post television critic Tom Shales called the Super Bowl of sleaze. The rest of the MTV-produced halftime show had lots more bumping and grinding, crotch-grabbing rappers, and background girls tossing off their wardrobes to "I'm Getting So Hot, I Wanna Take My Clothes Off." Then there were the commercials, often creative and funny at Super Bowls, but this year featuring horse flatulence, a trained dog that bites men again in the crotch to steal their beer, a monkey leering at a girl's breasts and suggesting they go upstairs, and several ads for erectile dysfunction. Bud Light clearly won the night's award for the most stupid, crude, and banal ads, while only Homer Simpson seemed to offer any healthier and funny alternative fare. My 5-year-old son Luke was playing with his friends in another room, but walked in just in time to see a spot for Van Helsing, an upcoming and not yet rated horror film that featured very disturbing and graphic images of horrific violence. Seeing the fanged monsters leering at us through the screen literally stopped him in his tracks. Because of substantial public outcry, CBS issued some unconvincing apologies about how surprised they were at Janet's bare bust in this first public revelation of the Jackson family values. and insisted they had been to all the rehearsals and never seen it before. While the impressive young Timberlake preserved both his intelligence and integrity by blaming the whole thing on a wardrobe dysfunction, which, as we all know, happens all the time in Hollywood. There was certainly a lot of dysfunction going on here, but it has to do with much more than outfits. You want to know why people join the religious right? It may have less to do with wanting to take over the country than being desperate to protect their kids from the crass trash and degrading banality that media conglomerates like Viacom, which owns both CBS and MTV, seem to think is just fine family entertainment for Super Bowl night. Fortunately, my kids were in bed before the halftime show. But next year, we may just go with Mary Poppins in the other room. Again, some people think that only right-wing conservatives care about such moral pollution. Wrong. Most parents that I know, liberal or conservative, care a great deal about it, as do most self-respecting women and men. It defies ingrained stereotypes to suggest that a healthy, moral consistency applies to personal and sexual ethics as well as to social and political values. It's time to break out of those old ideological shibboleths and forge a unified front against the amoral corporate greed that violates all our ethics, personal and social, by creating a system that sells beer and breasts in the same advertising plans just to make a buck. The real family values questions go much deeper than the apparent differences between the political parties. The really important issue is parenting. I met Anna Greenberg when I was teaching at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Anna has done extensive research on the question of values, which has included serious attention to the perspectives of diverse religious communities. One of the most important issues Greenberg has focused on is the politics of marriage. Greenberg says it would be easy for Democrats to dismiss this Republican morality advantage as an artifact of the influence of fringe religious writers. But it is evident in a broad swath of voters, and a large portion of those voters are married. But does this mean that married Americans are hijacked by the Christian right? Hardly. A more likely story is that when people get married and have children, their new experiences alter their political concerns. First, parents often return to the religious fold after dropping off from worship when they left their childhood home for work or college. Second, people with children have concerns that did not occur to them when they were childless. Parents worry about their kids' exposure to sex and violence on television, in music, and on the internet. They worry about school safety and the impact of peer pressure on taking drugs or committing violence. Single adults, and especially men, just don't think about these issues as much as married people do. In one survey Greenberg cites, only 16% of single men thought that sex and violence on television were a very serious problem, compared with 47% of married men. By comparison, 42% of single women and 56% of married women thought they were a problem. Most of the data support the contention that what is wrong with families, in the perception of most Americans, is lack of responsible parenting. From violence-torn inner cities to suburban Littleton, Colorado, where upper-middle-class students shot down their classmates at Columbine High School, a lack of parental supervision and discipline is at the heart of the problem. And most tellingly, Greenberg reports her respondents saying that the biggest challenge facing parents is insufficient time and commitment to teach children respect for rules and responsibility. That finding is confirmed by many other national surveys, showing that the pressures of parenting are as important as any of the other worries that most Americans have these days. Such findings indicate that the answer to the family values crisis may not be a return to traditional roles for men and women and combating gay marriage, as the right suggests, but rather in supporting the critical task of parenting, culturally, morally, and economically. Here again, both the right and the left are failing us. The Republican definition of family values, which properly stresses moral laxness, but ignores the growing economic pressures on all families, simply doesn't go deep enough. Similarly, The Democrats are right when they focus on economic security for working families, but wrong when they are reluctant to make moral judgments about the cultural trends and values that are undermining family life. Stagnant wages, the loss of health care and other job benefits, the rising cost of housing, and the demands of multiple jobs for low-income workers are all an assault on family time and values. But even in middle and upper-middle-class households, the growing pressure for two incomes has led to the latchkey syndrome that forces young people and families up and down the income ladder to look after themselves. Greenberg reports that people are working more hours to keep up, but we have no real support for childcare or family leave, some of the biggest issues facing working families. This means people are working longer hours and spending less time at home. Little wonder Americans are feeling stressed about their ability to spend time with their children. Perhaps her key insight is this. Americans make the connection between moral decline, the challenge of parenting, and the economic squeeze. Americans do, but the political parties don't. Being new parents ourselves, with two young boys, my wife Joy and I talk to lots of other parents. Our experience suggests that mothers and fathers across the political spectrum now regard parenting in America as a countercultural activity. When I make such a statement on the road, all the parents in the audience begin nodding their heads, whether they are political liberals or conservatives. The values of a materialistic and hedonistic culture are clearly arrayed against our raising children with moral and spiritual values. Objecting to the spiritual formation of the television and media culture is no longer an issue that is liberal or conservative.